nilqawkom għal kreattività bla konfini li huwa program fuq Campus FM organizzat mid-Dipartiment tal-Istorja tal-Arti fl-Università ta' Malta. Dan il-program ħaj jiddiskuti arti, riċerka fil-Dipartiment, kif ukoll avvenimenti kulturali li se jseħħu fix-xhur li ġejjin. Jiena Audrey Rose Mizzi u se jkun qed nippreżenta dan il-programm flimkien ma' artisti, mużiċisti u studenti li qed jagħmlu riċerka fid-Dipartiment tal-Istorja tal-Arti.
Hello, today you'll be joining me, Nikki, and Frederica Jus, who's another PhD candidate within the Department of History of Art. Hi, Fred.
Hi, Nick.
Thanks for coming today.
Thank you for inviting me.
We have several occasions discussed each other's research and the problems involved with being a PhD student, which we won't enter into today, not to give our audience, our listeners, a headache. But the purpose of today's program is, of course, to talk about your research, Fred, and how things are developing and some maybe new interesting points that have emerged over the past 2 years. Could you, before we enter into your PhD research, could you give us a bit of a resume of your MA research, which I find extremely interesting?
So I started out my BA, which then continued into an MA on Palazzo Parisio and Nashar. When I started it, I didn't really know what it was going to entail. I thought, you know, the archives would be there, letters would be documented, everything would be in order. And it wasn't actually. I went into studying the artistic program of Palazzo Parisio, so the painted work, the sculptured work, the work in stucco, and basically investigating what the patron Giuseppe Scicluna wanted to create with his palace. The family are still around and they're still very active. They still own the palace. They take care of it very well. So it was very easy to coordinate with them, to check archives, to check sketches. And, well, I found out that basically Giuseppe Scicluna wanted to emulate something in Italy, something in Sicily specifically. So he brought over an architect, he brought over the designers, the artists, the sculptors.
Fred, by something in Italy, do you mean a similar building that already existed?
Yes, there are letters to his own personal architect, Annibale Lupi, sending him, he sent him all the way around Italy to see all these different palaces, to go and visit Pompeii because he wanted to emulate the Pompeian style in his palace. So this architect could get an idea, and he sent him specifically to a palace in Palermo, owned by a geologist, Whitaker, and basically, you know, he went to see that, get pictures of it, sketches of it, and go back to Giuseppe Scicluna so Giuseppe could see if he liked it or not.
And was Whitaker's place as eclectic as
Totally. Okay. I mean, he had a tea garden, you know, one room just decorated with lots of birds because he was interested in birds, Pompeian style everywhere, marble, different paintings chosen not because of their style, but because of their size. So to create symmetry on the walls, everything just mismatch of hodgepodge of styles, but it works in eclecticism.
Yes. It's very 19th century, no?
It's very turn of the 20th century. In fact, Palazzo Parisio is very late 19th century, but also it has the first expression of Art Nouveau style in Malta, which dates to the beginning of the 20th century, so it's very early considered.
Yes, and in fact, the decorative scheme, as far as I remember, was finished by 1907.
Yeah, well, 1906, the Marquis moved in, but he died in 1907.
Yes, I remember, he just finished his,
which kind of was good because everything was preserved as in its original form. The curtains were still found, you know, in their boxes, preserved. They hadn't ever been put up yet, 100 years later.
And then his family continued to live there after he died?
His family lived sort of on the property, on the estate. Basically, Giuseppe Scicluna played Pac-Man in Nashar and bought the main Palazzo Parisio and then
all
the houses around it. So he created a massive estate. And his family lived on the property, but the palazzo was closed down. It wasn't really used, you know, they didn't used to use it as their main house.
Okay.
Then it was opened as a wedding venue. I'm not 100% sure. It was like used by the family for, you know, their own events. But then I think open to the public in the 70s.
Okay. So it has been being used as event venue for quite a while then. But I remember when you had given your public lecture on your MA research about 2 years ago now, I found the place to be fascinating because it really is like every room is designed according to particular historical styles.
I mean, and
plans. Quite faithfully, really.
Yes, yes.
But it's reproduction, you know?
It's reproduction, but yes, that's the thing, because I mean, in the plans, they literally picked a style for each room. So in the plans, you see the dining room, Pompeii, the Sala Lombarda, Sala Lombarda, you know, then the Louis style, so Louis the 14th, Louis the 15th, Louis the 16th, and they literally follow that style for that room, but it doesn't make sense, you know, Pompeian, what does Pompeian have to do with Louis the 14th style, but then altogether it makes sense as a whole.
In fact, the whole, you delivered your lecture and was kind of like a mini Versailles ball of mirrors.
The ballroom, yes. And in fact, for that room, I was lucky enough to find some of the original sketches by the architect and the detail he went into. He literally sketched each decoration in minute form, sent it to Malta. There's a brilliant letter as well where he explains that he's sending a sketch of the long wall, the short wall, and the ceiling. So he sent all these sketches from Catania to Malta, gave it to the two sculptors, Giulio Moschetti and Cardona, and basically, you know, they reproduced these sketches in the ballroom.
Yes, it's a really fascinating place. And I think, I mean, Scicluna's relative then, later relative, was also Giuseppe Scicluna, as far as I remember.
Or John Scicluna, his son?
Not his son. I think a later relative was a close artistic collaborator of Gabriel Caruana. He was also Marquis Giuseppe Scicluna, the person who created Mystique.
Yes, that's John Scicluna, I believe.
Is he? So my mistake.
He was Giuseppe Scicluna's grandson.
Okay.
They never actually met, but yes, he probably
grandson.
Had the same interest as a patron, especially when you consider Mystique.
No, because exactly, when you see Mystique, and then you see, I mean, of course, Mystique is completely different to Palazzo Parisio, but that same interest.
Yes, in, that same going all out for a property, you know, make it
juxtaposition of these different things. And I found it would be interesting to have a study on this particular Scicluna, because even I've seen works that he produced at Gabriel Caruana studio and
he was an artist himself as well. He was a musician as well.
Yes, his abstracts are really interesting.
There's a good video on YouTube of him taking people around Mystique and explaining.
Yes,
the
I haven't seen this. I will look this
it's
up.
It's good. It's good. And he was quite an artistic,
interesting
quite an
family.
Eccentric.
Really interesting family. But Palazzo Parisio, because we're talking about past styles, but I find it interesting, of course, that there's the Art Nouveau aspect, so he also managed to integrate something a bit more contemporary.
Yes, and contemporary, very contemporary, and all for each room, all the furniture, everything was designed specifically for the markers, for that style, for that room. So in the Art Nouveau room, the ceiling is painted, the walls were painted, unfortunately now that decoration doesn't survive, and the furniture as well was all Art Nouveau furniture. In fact, the family used to call it the peacock room because it was all, you know, furniture based on a peacock. And there's just one photo they have that shows the room in its original form. Otherwise, the ceiling now is the only.
And this is in the private archives of the family?
Yes, the private archives of the family, which when I started research, I don't think they realized how important they actually were, these archives. So, you know, I kind of went to the house, everything on the floor, everything scanned and properly recorded and arranged as well, organized. And there were basically all the letters, well, most of them, let's say, kept by the Marco Scicluna when he was, you know, transporting the marble, when he was speaking to the architect, some problems with the sculptors, a lot of interesting things. So you could really see how, one, he was an active patron, and apart from having such a say in the design of the palace, he was also coordinating a lot of importation, sending his architects things, even commissioning photos and then having to send them back. So he was very active in that. And the fact that he kept the letters as well shows that he, you know, really cared about his project.
Yes. And did any of the architects, artists, artisans who worked on Palazzo Parisio also continue to work on other projects in Malta?
Yes, I mean, Giulio Moschetti, it was one of his last works, and Giuseppe Valenti as well. So they were kind of, you know, the 19th century sculptors who had come from Italy to Malta and made the gear, themselves a reputation over here. And then Cardona carried on, you know, teaching in school and became quite important as a sculptor. And the artists, Filippo Venuti and Giacomo Olzai, Giacomolz, I went back to Italy, and Venuti stayed in Malta, but he was kind of as well at the end of his career. He wasn't just starting out.
Mm-hmm. And what about the people who worked on the Art Nouveau aspect of Palazzo Parisio?
It's a question mark, because we're not entirely sure who worked on it. I mean, the stucco decoration, and there's, you know, the coat of arms of the School of Art. So that, like, points to Cardona, I guess, who was at the time headmaster of the School of Art and sort of took 5 years off from his post to work in Palazzo Parisio with his students. So it was probably Maltese artists directed by either Carlo Sada, the main architect and designer of the palace, or by Cardona, question mark.
And what interests me as well inside Palazzo Parisio were the portraits by Edward Carmona Dingley,
yes,
produced of the family, because even they are quite eclectic. When you in the entrance hall, there is the one of the Marquesa
and her daughter.
But then upstairs, which is quite within the standard parameters of Edward Carmona Dingley's portraiture, the whole setting, the way it's painted. However, upstairs in one of the rooms, I cannot remember which music room. It was a small room on the side.
Yes, exactly, the music room.
There is the portrait of the
Mignon.
The sitter. Is it Mignon?
Yes, Mignon Marshall, who is still alive.
Is she?
Yes.
Well, as a shepherdess.
As a shepherdess, I mean, very Arcadian, no?
It reminds me of a lot of Rococo portraits.
Yes, and the story of that is, I believe just before the war, the Marchesa Violetta Testaferrata basically commissioned Carmona Dingley to paint her daughter's portrait. And in that time, Carmona Dingley didn't have such a great reputation, no, for painting women. So it was quite wow of her to go and commission a portrait just before the war. And she liked it so much that after the war, she commissioned her own portrait and of her other daughter, which are now in the entrance hall.
Uh-huh.
But that
now, those
was
are really
the
late ones, in
the,
fact.
Very late on, just after the war.
Exactly, because Carmona Dingley died in 1950.
So, exactly.
So, some of his last.
And she, I think there's a letter that she wrote to Carmona Dingley, and she specifically said how she liked, you know, I mean, the figure of her daughter was painted in a very sensual way, which women at the time were not so keen on. But
well, it's not something you really saw, Malta. A woman was never portrayed in a sensual way.
Exactly. And she really liked this aspect of it. So she kind of wrote back to Carmona Dingley, wow, I love this portrait and you must paint my own and of my other daughter. So she was quite as well radical as a female patron.
I think they are quite an exciting family overall.
Yes.
Really.
Now, Violetta was married to John Cicluna. So John was Giuseppe's son.
Okay.
He was quite a quiet character, apparently, from what I've read and from what I've heard about him. And then his wife was this really eccentric, so, you know, figure going to all these balls. She was a musician as well, and she was quite an exciting character.
There is a portrait by Robert Carmona Dingley of one of the Cicunas, and it was actually the last portrait that Robert produced, because there's a note of payment which is held in the family archives, and it's dated a few months before Robert died. So that's like another interesting point between the brothers. But of course, Edward is the one who takes dominance within the number of portraits being produced for the Cicluna family. Anyway, Fred, so Palazzo Parisio. I was very happy with your research and glad to hear of all these new developments happening in the beginning of the beginning of the 20th century in Malta. Mm. So on to your PhD, which is under the supervision of Professor Keith Chuberras.
And now I've gone back in time. I decided the turn of the 20th century was okay, done and dusted. So I've gone back to the beginning of the 17th century now for my PhD, studying Grandmaster Wignacourt and him as a patron for the fresco cycle at the Grandmaster's Palace by a Bolognese artist, Leonello Spada.
So can you tell us a bit about Leonello Spada first?
So Leonello Spada was very important in the Carracci Academy, Annibale Carracci, so the ones who were starting Bolognese classicism.
beginning, we're talking about the very beginning of the Baroque period.
Yes, the beginning of the Baroque style, mm-hmm. one of the starters of it, the instigators. And unfortunately, I have to accept this as part of my research. He wasn't the best artist over there. So by the time he was commissioned by Wignacourt in 1609, probably 1608, they started discussions with him.
So why Caravaggio was in Malta then?
Just after he left.
Ah, yes, exactly, just after he left.
Basically, all the Bolognese artists from Bologna had moved to Rome. They were being commissioned by the cardinals, the patron, the popes, you know, very important people. Leonello Spada didn't move to Rome. He stayed in Bologna, stayed working in the academy, probably because he wasn't the greatest artist, so he thought, actually, he probably thought it was a lucky break for him that all the great artists were leaving Bologna and he could enjoy commissions from there. Now, Grandmaster Wignacourt wrote to Alessandro Orsi, his receiver in Bologna, and Alessandro Orsi probably went to the Carracci Academy, knocked on the door, who wants to come to Malta and paint the Grandmaster's palace? And one of, you know, the best artists there at the time was Leonello Spada.
It's quite fascinating that this information traveled so fast. So do you think that Wignacourt already knew that Bologna was the place to look for potential artists?
Now, that's a very, very interesting thing about the research. First, in 1606, Wignacourt wrote to Florence for a frescante, for someone to come and paint the palace. This artist was, I don't know, you know, the commission was very advanced. He was meant to come to Malta, stop in Naples to buy pigment, and we don't know what happened. We don't know if this artist came to Malta. We just know that he didn't fresco these three rooms that Leonello Spada painted. Next thing we know is Caravaggio's in Malta. Probably, possibly, I'm sure, but, you know, Wignacourt met with Caravaggio, greatest artist, took him to the palaces, and I have these three rooms, will you fresco them for me? And what would Caravaggio have said? No, I don't do fresco, but you should write to Bologna, because at the moment in Rome, the Bolognese are the best.
So that's your suspicion of how this
that's my suspicion,
contact
yes.
is established, okay.
But then again, Wignacourt, in his letters at the time, was always in contact with people in Rome. So even though there's no letter asking someone, listen, who should I write to for a frescante? He was, you know, he probably knew that the Bolognese were at the forefront of fresco painting.
Yes, and this was, I mean, they had started, as far as I remember, the very end of the 16th century, the Bolognese school.
Pretty much 1600, yeah, yes,
exactly.
And then they went to Rome, so the style went public in Rome.
Yes, so we're talking about their first decade, so I mean,
yes,
it's in their
exactly.
first decade, which is
so
quite incredible.
Malta, by 1610, had work by Caravaggio and by a student of Annibale Carracci, so Bolognese classicism and the realist Caravaggio style, so it's very important, even internationally, using Malta as an example for the exportation of the style. Which mm-hmm. is kind of links to Palazzo Parisio, how the style of Sicily, of Italy, was exported to Malta.
Yes,
and how
really,
patrons
really
continually look to Italy to get artists, architects, ideas.
Yes.
And
I mean, this has continued even until today. I mean, the fact that, for example, the government sent Lorenzo Piano,
exactly,
of all architects,
exactly.
to come and work on the Citygate project. So that link with Italy has been very, very hard to break.
It's always been there, even before the knights came to Malta, you know, they were always, I mean, it's, we're
but
close to Italy,
there's very obvious historical, cultural reasons for it.
I wonder if, you know, the artistic centre of that time, if it were Paris, people would have gone to Paris instead of Italy.
Yes, and know. In fact, Maltese artists in the 20th century did go to Paris.
Exactly.
But the link with Italy remained rather strong, and it was very, very hard to overcome, really. But I love this aspect that this, let's say, artistic shift into the Baroque, what we call the Baroque period today, happened. So it was so immediate, basically.
Yes.
And do you know of any other place outside of Italy where this development took place as fast as it did in Malta?
No. I mean, another place would be Sicily, because, you know, Caravaggio was there after Malta, but then there was no Bolognese classicism. So you can't kind of compare the two pillars of the Baroque style that were in Rome, anywhere else than in Malta.
Yes, and but then they were exported elsewhere, right?
Yes, they were exported. But, you know, to have the artists actually working on the island, in the country, in the place, no, it's only Malta.
Incredible. So, the another spot. And now let's move on to discussing the actual fresco cycle.
Okay, so the fresco cycle is spread basically in over three rooms. And what's depicted is the early history of the order, which was, you know, from 1060, right before they came to Malta, 1522. And the frescoes are divided. The first two rooms deal with the Holy Land, and the third room with their expulsion from the Holy Land and before coming to Malta. So yeah, Sahar, it's quite a long history to paint, so they chose specific episodes. And this is another facet of my research that basically I have to see what the sources were. Leonello Spada wouldn't himself have researched and thought of the episodes to paint of the early history of the order. He didn't know the early history of the order. And that links me to Giacomo Bosio's great history of the order, which he published from 1595 to 1602. We know that Wynyacourt was a keen patron of the last volume of this. It was started by Grandmaster Verdal. And just literally one of Wynyacourt's first letters after being elected as Grand Master, he writes to Giacomo Bosio in Rome and tells him, listen, hurry up with your third volume, write it, publish it, let's get it done. So after being the patron of the third volume of the history of the order, Wynyacourt then wanted this history painted. Now, when I started, I looked at the frescoes first, I must admit, I wasn't very well versed in the history of the order, the early history of the order. So I looked at the frescoes first and then I started reading contemporary books on it.
Yes, I think it's very good that you started with the visual material first.
Yes, and I was quite surprised because the frescoes are very triumphant, you know.
Yes.
But then when you start reading about the history, you realize how tragic it is.
This is quite a tragic story, actually.
And the knights really, they were cruel, they lost a lot of land, a lot of, you know, loss of the Holy Land was, you know, because of mistakes from them. And basically, they only survived because they had money as nobles.
Yes.
Otherwise, they would have been wiped out way, you know, after the first few years, probably.
Yes.
So that start, you start to think, okay, there's a lot of propaganda in this fresco cycle, obviously, in the Grand Master's Palace. In three main reception rooms, you know, you wouldn't want visitors seeing how tragic your history was, and then triumphant with the great siege, the frescoes by Peristaleccio. So anyway, Wynyacourt or Bosio, well, Bosio's book does give a propagandist slant to the works. More just, or rather than propaganda, it's, you know, leaning in favour towards the knights.
Yes, kind of like a historical revisioning of, yes, of what happened to make it a bit more...
Exactly. And when they were, the knights were cruel to the Turks. Like, there was one episode, they sort of had a lot of prisoners, Turkish prisoners. The Turkish released theirs, and then the knights decided to kill the Turkish prisoners, you know, so very cruel.
Yes.
And Bosio, when he writes about that, he kind of says, you know, that they had to do it because of, they did it for Christianity, for the order.
A justification for cruel acts.
Gives a religious justification. And, you know, he kind of makes excuses for them, so it doesn't look as bad as it really is.
Yes.
So that's, yes, it's laced with that propaganda slant.
And so the episodes that are shown are rather favourable.
Yes, definitely. I mean, even, let's say, there's one scene where the knights are presenting a relic of the True Cross to the King of Hungary. And when you see the fresco, you think, wow, like how great, how rich the knights were and all that. The episode before that is the knights ransacking the city which the King of Hungary owned, the city of Zara. And basically, you know, it was Christians against Christians. The Pope was furious. He was threatening to excommunicate the knights. And instead of showing that episode, they show when, you know, they're presenting the relic to the king to kind of say sorry for what they did.
Yes. That's, of course, that's very interesting because the palace was intended to host particular people, right?
Who are, exactly.
Who are traveling to Malta for some sort of diplomatic relations with the knights, uh-huh, or...
I mean, at the moment,
the
presidency on. So the palace is fantastic. It's full of European ministers, and which is what it would have been like at
yes,
the time
exactly.
that Spada was painting.
Exactly.
And I love, you know, trying to compare and trying to see the context of Leonello Spada's time
exactly.
and Wynyacourt's.
So, I mean, Vinyako's decision, autistic decision, has continued to resonate today, right?
Yes,
because it continues to show a very, very positive outcome of Maltese history and the bravery of the knights, and of course how they saved Katakura from the Ottoman Empire. And that idea, that historical idea, continues to be proliferated today. But even the way we're taught this history, right?
The way we thought this is, yes. I mean, I had no idea it was so... The history of the order was so tragic. And even the fact that they came to Malta, I remember it had impressed me when we were at university in lectures, that they didn't want to settle in Malta. It was kind of a last resort for them. We grow up with this idea that the knights came to Malta, they loved it, they settled here, they built Valletta, they won the Great Siege. Mm-hmm. But in actual fact, they came here as a last resort, and it was only after the Great Siege that they decided to settle here, build Valletta, and then it was only, you know, Vinyakot's time, really, and La Cassienne, the 1580s, started, you know, okay, let's decorate our palace, let's show our history. So it was really till then until Bozio that they started recording the history.
Yeah, so it took about 50 years then from when they arrived?
Yes.
So, and we're taught this, the knight's history as a heroic narrative,
definitely,
right?
But it was... I almost far from it. There were, yes, definitely heroic episodes in the early history, but let's say they're very heroic in Spada's frescoes.
Yes, very triumphant. I remember when you delivered your paper inside one of the rooms, mm-hmm. just a month or two ago, you had mentioned that you spotted Spada's self-portrait in one of the frescoes.
Yes, so one of the things was, okay, Spada, this was one of Spada's greatest commissions, and where is his signature in the frescoes? His name was forgotten about and only rediscovered in 1994 and attributed to the frescoes. So anyway, one day I was looking at the frescoes, walked into the last room, looked up at the last fresco, and there he was, Leonello Spada, looking back at me. And I realized that, he painted his own self-portrait in the frescoes.
Yes, and then we went into, I remember after your lecture, we followed you into the last room to look at this portrait, which is, I mean, rather
striking.
And it is striking. As soon as you walk in,
it
does hit you. Anyway, so unfortunately we have to stop here.
Okay.
But of course there's a lot, much more to discuss and much more to go into possibly in future. Thanks, Fred, for coming.
Thank you, Nikki.
And we hope to hear more about your research soon.
Thank you.
Wasalna fl-aħħar tal-programm Kreativita bla Konfini li huwa programm fuq Campus FM, organizzat mid-Dipartiment tal-Istorja tal-Arti fl-Università ta' Malta. Nixtiequ ninformaw l-udjenza tagħna li l-APS imdina qed jiġi l-Contemporary Art Biennale se jiġi mtella fil-Mużew tal-Katedra l-Imdina bejn it-13 ta' Novembru 2017 sas-7 ta' Jannar 2018. APS Bank huwa l-partner uffiċjali tal-Imdina Biennale. Għal-aktar informazzjoni nħeġġukom titħlu fuq is-sit elettroniku www.imdinabiennale.com. Grazzi tal-li naqattu magħna, niltaqgħu l-ġimgħa d-dieħla.